This week on Out in the Bay, something a little different. I'm Kendra Klang, one of the producers behind the scenes on Out in the Bay. When I started working with Eric to bring this show back on the air, wow, a year ago now, we talked mostly about amplifying queer voices and stories, but also about increasing LGBTQ visibility and building allies within the cisgender heterosexual community. So, you may hear my voice every once in a while, hosting shows with allies in mind. Like today, what to do when your child comes out to you. My guest is Dr. Caitlin Ryan, a social worker and the director of the Family Acceptance Project at San Francisco State University. Dr. Ryan has been working to promote the health and well-being of queer youth since the 1990s and co-founded the Family Acceptance Project in 2002 to help ethnically, racially, and religiously diverse families learn to support their LGBTQ kids. She's here today to discuss the health risks to queer youth when parents reject their identity, serious risks such as increased rates of suicide, drug use, and homelessness, and also to highlight what parents and families can do to promote the well-being of their LGBTQ kids. Welcome, Dr. Caitlin Ryan. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Caitlin, you were working in Atlanta during the AIDS epidemic, and your experiences there really shaped your career. What did you see at that time that led you to start the Family Acceptance Project with Dr. Rafael Diaz?
In 1980, I was accepted into Smith College School for Social Work, and they have a program where they send the graduate students, at that time it was around the U.S. and now it's in other countries as well, to do their clinical training. So they sent me to Atlanta right at the beginning of the AIDS epidemic, and people in the community knew that I had done early LGBT health organizing work. So as AIDS began to emerge and it was really ravaging the Atlanta community all over the South, the community asked me to help develop the first AIDS organization, Aid Atlanta. So I did that. And as part of that work, I became the first director. That was the first AIDS organization in the South. So young people came to Atlanta from all over the region to come to a big city where they could try to integrate their lives without embarrassing their families or, you know, causing a rift at home. So very few of them were actually out to their families. And part of my work, because people lived for such a short time after their diagnosis, was to meet families when they would come from these small cities and towns across the South. And they would come to the bedsides of their dying children. And many of them had no idea that this young gay or bisexual man was gay or bisexual or had AIDS. And they would find that out at the same time, and they were devastated. The media certainly talked about the terrible experiences of parents rejecting their children or coming into the home after a partner had died and taking everything and not even letting the surviving partner come to the funeral. And that happened, and it was terrible, and it was so widespread. But there was another side as well. There were the stories of families who, when their children were dying at the portal of death, would have done anything to change the future and to change the present and couldn't. And I saw how devastated they were. And I also realized that there was an opportunity for change, and there had to be a way to create an approach, a framework that would help these diverse families from different cultural and religious backgrounds learn to support what today we would call their LGBTQ children. And so that seed was formed, that idea was set, and some years later, really 21 years later, when I was recruited to come to San Francisco to start an institute at San Francisco State, I met Rafael Diaz. We worked together there, and I had an opportunity to start the Family Acceptance Project, which I did with Rafael, and we carried out at that time the first research on the families of LGBTQ youth and young adults together, you know, with their families. That had not been done before. I know it sounds really kind of shocking that it hadn't happened, but so much research and work hadn't been done. And our research was designed not just to do research, but to do research that would develop the first evidence-based family support model that would help these ethnically, racially, religiously, culturally diverse families with LGBTQ children learn how to support them and learn to support them in the context of their cultural worlds. So we did that. And when we started that work, people didn't believe that families, especially diverse families, could learn to support their LGBTQ children. The perception was that they were all rejecting, that none of them could change, that they couldn't grow, that they didn't want to. The perception even was that they wanted to reject and hurt their children. So all of the services that were available, including the emerging services for LGBTQ young people, not only did not include families, but they typically would exclude families. So I remember the mom of a 14-year-old gay youth who said to me one day, well, you know, when we found out about our son, we wanted to help him. We wanted to figure out how to support him. So we looked for organizations that could provide some peer support so we could have some friends. And we found out that the organization near us and the others, they wouldn't let parents come. Parents couldn't come to that program. They couldn't see meet the people there who were providing these services. Services typically ran from a 14-year-old to a 21-year-old, and we didn't want our child to be interacting with adults who might be, you know, using drugs or sexually active. And we wanted to know the environment for our child, and that wasn't possible because they didn't really think that we could help our child. And so that was the standing perception across the U.S. and other countries. So our research was a sea change when it was published. It really began to change the perceptions of everyone that it was possible to work with families, that they could learn to support their LGBTQ children. And that's, in fact, what we proceeded to do over the 20 years since that time.
Tell me a little bit more about your research. You spoke extensively to children, to their families, and came up with 100 different rejecting and accepting behaviors that parents and caregivers often do when their child comes out to them. Tell us a little bit more about those behaviors.
We collected thousands of pages of interview transcripts. We did all of this work bilingually, biculturally, in English and Spanish. And in these extensive interviews, across all different kinds of experiences, we identified over 100 specific ways that parents and caregivers responded to their LGBTQ child. And that included about half of them were rejecting behaviors and half of them were accepting behaviors. And then we took those behaviors and developed measures to be able to study how the presence and frequency of those behaviors and other kinds of experiences impacted risk and well-being as a young adult. So what we ended up finding was that the presence and frequency of these behaviors, the amount of these behaviors, and even whether they happened or not, had a huge impact on that young person's risk and wellness and sense of the future and hopefulness, relationships as a young adult. And so we took that work, we took it back to many of the families and young people in the first part of our study. We expanded our research to include families from other cultural, language, faith backgrounds. We did this work in about 5 languages then to have them teach us how to unpack our research, what it meant, how to message it, how to frame it, what kinds of materials were needed to help families from their cultural world learn to support their LGBTQ children. So then we started developing multicultural, multilingual, research-based family education tools and resources that we've been disseminating in California, all across the U.S. and in other countries. Our family education booklets, for example, these materials are on our website, have been disseminated to about 600,000 families, providers, religious leaders, young people in 70 different countries.
That's fantastic. What are some of the most common reactions you see when LGBTQ youth come out to their parents, and has that changed over time?
The most common reaction is ambivalence. So the parent or caregiver might give the child a hug, but not take their identity seriously, or secretly hope I hope they're not gay or transgender or bisexual, because that's going to be really hard for our family because of our cultural or religious beliefs. And that still, I think, is a more common reaction, where the parent will say to the child, I love you. But if you talk to that youth later, they would say, well, my parent cares about me, but they never talk about who I am. They don't know my work in the community. I'm involved with this queer youth organization where I'm the secretary, or I'm the vice president, or I'm in a leadership role, or there's somebody special in my life that I'd love to tell my parents about, but I know that they would really disapprove and they might not even let me see them anymore. So many young people have fears that their parents will reject them, even if they're in a family that's ambivalent, or even if they're in a family and they're not out, where that family would be accepting and affirming, because of the kind of cultural perception that parents don't accept their kids. And that cultural perception has persisted from generations past, and it's especially negative in families that are ethnically, racially, and religiously diverse.
Some parents may believe they're supporting or protecting their LGBTQ children when they're actually harming them. Tell us a little bit about unintended rejecting behaviors.
Well, actually, we found that all rejecting behaviors were unintended in terms of harm. We also found that all rejecting behaviors are focused on trying to change, prevent, minimize, deny their child's LGBTQ identity. That's what the parents are trying to do, even though the frequency of how they try to do that or the ways they try to do that may be different. You have a parent, for example, that never talks about their child's identity. They're giving them a message that this is not okay. You also have the parents that refuse to use their child's chosen name or pronouns. They're actively saying, I disagree, this is not okay. And then you have parents that physically hurt their LGBTQ child using slurs and negative and rejecting names for that LGBTQ child. And all of these behaviors are harmful, although the parents think that trying to change their child will help them. It'll help them have a good life, make sure that people respect them, that they fit in, that they can keep their family together now or in the afterlife. So it's really important to understand the parents' motives. I think on the outside, many people, especially in the queer community, see those parents as trying to hurt their children or maybe even try to kill them. But from the parents' perspective, they believe that what they're doing is helping their child. And part of the reason they believe that is they learn about this, about sexual orientation and gender identity, in a cultural context. This information is transmitted intergenerationally. They learn about it in a closed social world, so that families that are rejecting, this is their go-to response. These are their go-to reactions. And so what we're able to do because of our research is to show them how these behaviors that they may be engaging in to support their child can actually put them at great harm, contributes to serious health risks, and could even end in suicide. And parents are shocked to learn about this.
How does the Family Acceptance Project help parents and families reconcile their kids' LGBTQ identity with their culture or faith?
Well, what we do in terms of working with families that are struggling, first of all, we do a really thorough assessment up front. So we learn about their cultural and religious values and beliefs, so that we can frame our messaging and approach to working with those families from that perspective. So typical values for families are often keeping their family together, making sure that their children are happy and healthy, being connected in a new world. They may have emigrated from another culture and they want to maintain their culture here to support their family. So once we understand their underlying cultural beliefs and values, we can align our messaging and our framing and certainly our findings with those beliefs and values. So for example, even though many of the world's religions might reject homosexuality or not have necessarily long-term doctrine about gender diversity, but also reject gender diversity that is outside of their expectations and beliefs. Underlying the beliefs that homosexuality is wrong are religious values about mercy, compassion, love. So what we do is to, and underlying cultural beliefs and actions are other kinds of behaviors. Among Latino families, for example, respect is a really important cultural value, or, you know, the strength of the family, the heart of the family at the culture. So we use those cultural frames to, which are really familiar to families, to align our findings where we can show them that these behaviors are really harmful. If you reduce these behaviors or stop them, you can help protect your child from harm. These behaviors are helpful, and some of them you could start doing right now, and they don't require you to accept an identity that you think is wrong, but you can support your child to reduce risk. So we're introducing a completely different framework. We're introducing a new language, a new behavioral language that's empirically grounded, and also that's really simple. So we're talking about behavior, not their beliefs. So they don't perceive that their beliefs are being attacked or disrespected or disregarded. But we're interacting in the space where they connect to their child and to other families, which is around their values.
You're hearing Out in the Bay, queer radio from San Francisco. I'm Kendra Klang. My guest today is Dr. Caitlin Ryan, social worker and director of the Family Acceptance Project at San Francisco State University. We're discussing what to do when your child comes out to you. Caitlin, we've talked about rejecting behaviors now. What do LGBTQ kids really need to hear from their parents?
They need to hear that their parents love them, that they will support them, even if they disagree, even if they think that being gay or transgender is wrong. So every child whose parents learn, and it's not just that kids come out to their parents. Parents find out about their child's identity from many sources, from other people, from something that happens or might have happened at school, from a flyer in their kid's pocket when they're doing the laundry about resources, from links on the computer. And they are getting this information for the first time. Their child has been thinking about this for a very long time. But the most important thing I think that a parent could say to a child is, I love you. I'm going to be there for you. If they're struggling, to say, I don't understand. I don't have all the information, but we're going to learn about this together. And I'm going to be there for you no matter what. Because the greatest fear that LGBT young people have, even in families that when they come out are very accepting, are that their families will reject them. And they're hungering. We see out-of-home youth who are always hungering for even the smallest bit of acceptance and affirmation from their families. We're hardwired for connectedness, and the connection to our caregiver is the most important thing in our lives.
You brought up a point that I want to follow up on. If a parent finds a flyer or suspects that their child is LGBTQ, should they ask them?
Well, it depends on the level of communication that they've already had. Will the child freeze up and be freaked out because they never talk about anything? So I think the parent needs to decide the best way to respond. I'll give an example of one of the families in one of our family education films that we made with a very devout Mormon family with a gay son. And the mom read her son's diary because he had become increasingly withdrawn, depressed, his grades were dropping, all of the signals that he was at risk, and he was at high risk for suicide by the time the mom read his diary. So she discovered that he was attracted to boys, and she called her husband to come home from church, and they sat down and talked about it together, and they talked about the best way to prepare to ask him. So they didn't just blurt it out. They talked about it at a family level, and they didn't want to scare him. They didn't want him to be afraid. They wanted him to know that they loved him. And they were also really concerned because they didn't really know anybody gay. They didn't know what this meant for them, but they knew that they loved their child. They knew that he was at risk because of what they'd been seeing, and they wanted to help him. So that's how they responded. So I think rather than blurting something out, I think it's always wise to take a little time and think about what's going on in our lives, maybe during the pandemic, things have been really hard. Can we get any privacy to talk about this? Do we do this, you know, just with our child or is somebody else involved? So to approach this from the perspective of your family system and what's happening in your life.
Yeah, I think that's excellent advice for all parenting. I wanted to ask you more about COVID. The pandemic this year has resulted in so many kids and LGBTQ kids have lost access to these external support systems, schools, friend groups, role models. What can parents and families do to help lessen the effects of this pandemic on their LGBTQ kids?
I think they can draw from earlier life experiences. This is a time when I think history can help us. How did we as a society survive, you know, the major traumatic experiences in the lives of our elders, of our ancestors? All of us have had to go through difficult times. For our young people today, they haven't had a world event like this. But if we think about, for example, the world wars, which had a profound and powerful and devastating effect in so many ways for families and young people. If we think about the 1918 pandemic, if we think about other kinds of traumatic environmental disasters where they were experienced by a large number of people and families had to pull together and draw together, I think we need to call families to history and we need to call them to the inner strength that we have to be able to help one another in our responsibility to help one another. And I would hope that anyone listening to this broadcast would come to our website and look at the resources. There are ways to support your LGBTQ child to reduce their risk and help protect them from harm, even if you believe that being gay or transgender is wrong. You know, the accepting behaviors that we've identified and measured and done this work over a long period of time, behaviors like simply sitting and talking with your child and listening respectfully without interrupting or ridiculing them or punishing them. Finding out, what's it like for you? What's it been like? What are things that have happened in our family that were hurtful for you? What can we do together as a family? Standing up for that young person when other people mistreat them because of who they are. Because they're a member of our family, and if you're a religious person, because they're a child of God. Advocating for your child in all kinds of settings. These are things parents and caregivers can do, even if they think that being gay or transgender is wrong. And because their actions, rather than just words, they show the child that I care about you. I don't have all the answers, or this is hard for me, or it's, you know, I never did this before. I didn't know this, but I want to help you. I love you. I care about you. And those are powerful messages that could be making a profound difference.
You know, we're coming to the end of our program now, and I'm going to give you two scenarios to wrap up the show before we give our listeners information about where they can find out more about the Family Acceptance Project. And the first is the family is accepting, but doesn't have LGBTQ people in their either family or close circle of friends. How can they help their child find supportive LGBTQ friends and role models?
Well, first of all, they can go online. You know, most people have access to the huge range of internet information. And now there's so much more information that's available. We're preparing this national project that will have a central webpage where people can get information, including from ethnically and racially and religiously diverse families. Finding a positive role model to give your child a sense of the future is one of the positive, affirming, family-accepting behaviors that we identified and measured. So we know that that behavior helps reduce risk and promote well-being. And it also helps other family members see that their child can have a good life. So if they don't have a family member or know someone, if they go online, they can find more and more programs that are available. Now, I'll give a couple of examples. We are now doing Asian translations of our posters with lots of different groups. So Desi Rainbow Parents and Allies is a South Asian parent, family, ally group that provides education and support and online resources, all kinds of information for and activities for South Asian families with LGBTQ family members. So participating in that, they can meet other people. They can be with their, participate with their child on that event, on that online activity. It could be a parent and an adult child or a young adult child or someone even younger talking about their experiences as parents are doing. And this is a way that as a family, they can see not only positive validation, but they can see that they've done well, that one of the great fears of parents is my child won't have a job. No one will love them. They'll be alone. They'll be excluded. People will hurt them. So finding a positive role model is showing your child and the other family members that these stories today have happy endings.
The last question I wanted to ask you is, parents make mistakes all the time. I'm a parent. I'm constantly making mistakes with my kids. If a parent makes a mistake and is initially exhibiting rejecting behaviors, what can they do to make amends with their child? How can they reconcile?
Talk about it. Say, you know, when I first heard about this, I was unsure. I didn't think you knew. I didn't have the information I needed. Now I've learned more. And I've gone to the Family Acceptance Project website and I've seen that some of these behaviors that I was doing or that are, you know, your other caregivers have been doing really harmful. And I'm sorry. I didn't know how hurtful that was. I know now. And let's work together so that I can respond in the ways that are really going to be helpful for you. And I can get auntie and grandma and your father or others to understand this as well. Of course, we make mistakes. We all make mistakes. But I think the biggest mistake is never owning them or taking responsibility for it.
Caitlin, we're at the end of our time. Where can our listeners find and support your work?
Well, so they can come to our website, tell people about our work, learn more about it, read about it. Our family education booklets and our posters are now available in English and Spanish with the camera-ready art to download and take to the printer to print fabulous, you know, bright, colorful copies. We're in the process now of making those posters available in several Asian languages so they can download the art from our website and take them and use them. Our family education booklets are on our website. We also have those available in print copies. We've been developing family support videos, and I really need, you know, the funding to do that work. And we've been integrating our family support model into all different kinds of care settings, everything from behavioral health to foster care, child abuse prevention, faith-based mental health services, and we need funding for that. So please come to our website, donate to the Family Acceptance Project. We're affiliated with San Francisco State University. If you come to our website in the navigation bar on every page, you can see a place to donate. You can do it directly online or send us a check. No donation of any size is too small. We are grateful for any way that people can help us.
You've been listening to Out in the Bay. My guest this half hour was Dr. Caitlin Ryan, social worker and director of the Family Acceptance Project at San Francisco State University. Thank you for joining me, Caitlin.
You're welcome.
To learn more about Dr. Ryan and the Family Acceptance Project, check our website, outinthebay.org. Look for links at the bottom of our post for this week's show. That's outinthebay.org, where you can also hear this show and past shows and share them with friends. Sign up for our weekly email newsletter and subscribe to Out in the Bay via Stitcher and Apple Podcasts. Please also consider making a donation there. We'd love to keep bringing queer air to your ears. Our theme music was written and performed by Holly Mead. Thanks to Holly, and thanks to KALW 91.7 and San Francisco Public Press and its radio station, KSFP 102.5 FM, for bringing us back on the air. And big thanks to our fearless leader, Eric Jansen, and my co-producers, True Quinn and Porfirio Rangel. Want to join our team? Email us at outinthebaysf@gmail.com. That's outinthebaysf@gmail.com. Thank you for joining us out in the bay.